but Meek has been endorsed by President Obama and former President Bill Clinton. For NPR News, I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
The government's stepping up its investigation into Toyota Corollas and Matrix vehicles that may have defective engines. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says it's more closely examining problems that could cause engines to stall or fail to start. Toyota came under heavy scrutiny in the past year after it recalled about 11 million vehicles worldwide for other defects. A NATO operation aimed at bolstering security weeks ahead of a crucial vote in Afghanistan is running into Taliban resistance. International and Afghan forces reported today they killed 40 militants east of Kabul. The coalition also says two service members died while fighting in southern Afghanistan. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from U.S. Oncology, united with 1,300 oncologists nationwide to help patients fight cancer. Online at usoncology.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Matt Richtel of the New York Times about how digital technology is changing our lives and our brains. He says after 20 years of glorifying it, researchers are beginning to understand that technology has its downside.
When you're constantly interrupted by email, you are experiencing stress. Stress equals stress hormones. Stress hormones take their toll on the brain.
Join us
today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, knees, low back, neck, shoulders, and plus sizes. New classes start August 30th. Information at 344-YOGA, yoga-cu.com, and on Facebook.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, the producers, Kyle Mabry at the controls. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about a health topic. And we do from time to time have physicians on the show. We have people who are, we have a family practice doctor, for example. He's here every other month. We have an OBGYN who is here every other month. And then every once in a while, we have physicians who specialize in a particular part of the body or particular body systems. And that's what we're doing here this morning. We'll be talking about the digestive system. And our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist. She works at Christie Clinic in Champaign. And she's been good enough a number of times now to stop by on the program to talk a little bit about that. We've talked in the past, we've talked about things like colon cancer, which continues to be a big issue. We've talked about acid reflux, which seems to continue to be a big issue. We've talked about things like ulcers. We've talked about all sorts of things that have to do with the stomach and the intestines, everything from one end to the other. So we're here to try to answer questions, and I know that she'll do her best to deal with questions that are people calling in with. And I always say, as I go at the beginning, I always say, people have to remember that we're doing this over the telephone, so we can't really do diagnosis of people over the telephone. There are some limits on what we can do, but I think, can also give out some good basic information. And if people have questions, they should call. And I know the doctor will do her best to help you out. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And also we have email, so if you'd like to send your question that way, it's will-talk@illinois.edu. And thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here. Maybe just to pick one thing, we could start out and talk a little bit about colorectal cancer, which continues, I believe, to be the second big killer.
Yeah, of people. It's way up there.
And I think actually it's mostly, I think what we're talking about is colon cancer. I don't think that rectal cancer is actually all that common. Is that right?
Well, it's not uncommon. It's usually enveloped into the studies as part of due to colorectal cancer. So, okay. Yeah, it's there.
And it's something that that physicians and people in the health field have certainly been trying to promote much greater awareness about and talk to people about why screening is really so important. Has that actually helped?
Yes, it has. Colorectal cancer screening has helped significantly because in most patients, these cancers start out as benign polyps that can be removed and we can avoid even dealing with the cancer. So we have a benign growth that we can deal with, which is not always the case, for example, as lung cancers and maybe not even in breast cancers. So it has helped significantly. Studies have been done to show that there has been significant decrease in the incidence of colon cancer since we've started the colon screening.
Okay. So that's good. That's actually good news.
It's great news. Yeah.
There are some tests you can do. There's a basic test that you can do that's really easy that anybody can do that's non-invasive, where you test for little bits of blood in people's stool.
Right.
It's just really easy. It's not real expensive. Doesn't involve going and having anybody poked anywhere, which is a nice thing. I'm sure people would say it's a nice thing, but I guess that there's really no replacement for being able to actually look inside and see what's there. And it seems that for a long time, the basic way to do that has been to put a tube with a camera in there so that you can actually look. But I think that there are also other ways of doing it, or people are talking about other ways of trying to do that. What's really now where are we headed with that kind of screening?
Well, it's an interesting question. It really hasn't, over the last probably 5 to 10 years since most insurance companies have been approving screening colonoscopies be done, it has not changed a whole lot, but there are some other things that are out there. The stool testing that you were talking about, the hemocult testing, it's still there. It's been refined somewhat because these, unfortunately, are not fantastically accurate tests, both positive and negative always. But if they're done repeatedly on a yearly basis, that improves the accuracy and the reliability. But I think most people are not hanging their hats on that too much anymore. There are, of course, barium enemas that can be done instead of colonoscopies. Those tend to be less accurate because of the way they're doing. They're actually visualizing through fluoroscopy. Depends a lot on the quality of the preparation and how well the barium actually stuck to the walls of the colon. There is, however, another modality called a virtual colonoscopy, or more accurately, a CT colography, which in essence is a CAT scan-based barium enema, but it's done differently, and the accuracy of that is much higher than the barium enemas. Now, there some issues with that. If polyps are seen, then you have to go on with colonoscopy anyway to have it removed. It's really very much reader dependent, and at least in the Midwest, is not yet being covered except in special circumstances where a colonoscopy can't be done very well. It's not usually being covered by insurance companies. I believe I have heard, however, on the East Coast, it's starting to be covered as a screening tool by some insurance companies, and it probably will be eventually. But again, it's very dependent on how many, what type of training these people have had when they're reading the exams, and not quite ready for prime time overall. But it's out there, and it may be coming and becoming more popular.
Well, for right now, though, then the standard sounds like is colonoscopy, where what you're doing is you're putting in this flexible tube. It has a camera, so you can see. And then if there's something that concerns you, you can remove it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so that's still, as far as you're concerned, still now the gold standard as far as screening goes.
As gold as we can get on this, yes.
Okay. Yeah. But do you think that's at some point something else will come along to one of these other things that's essentially, it's a kind of an X-ray?
Right.
That something like that will come along and take the place of that?
Well, I'm still waiting for the Star Trek Zapper, where you just kind of scan the abdomen and you take care of everything. But I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime, at least. So there are some other things out there, such as the genetic stool testing as well. Again, I think that will become more and more important in the future as a better test to decide who should have actually a colonoscopy and who cannot, or who should not and doesn't need to. And actually, how comfortable the exams are as they become more comfortable, easier to do, and the prep is less of an issue to take, I think that will change things as well. I think the colonoscopies will always be out there. And in certain situations, that's still probably the better way of screening because it's saving you an extra test. So if you have a high probability of having colon polyps, your risk of colon cancer is higher. Either you've already had polyps or there's a strong family history at a younger age. Those patients probably should just go directly onto colonoscopy. It doesn't make sense. They're their risk of having something there to do something with is higher. They're just putting themselves through another test that does not make it cost effective.
And do you think there are a lot of people who are avoiding having the test just because either they have heard it's not pleasant or they just, you know, they're just thinking about it and they're thinking, well, I just don't want to do that?
Yeah, I think just from speaking with patients, there's definitely a delay sometimes when people come in. That's just not something that most people look forward to having to think about having done.
Yeah.
But the procedure itself is really not that bad. The preparation is probably the worst part. The procedure is done with sedation, and in most hands, it's fairly comfortable.
Okay. We have a caller here and others. If you're welcome, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. If you have questions about colon cancer or anything else that has to do with the digestive system, you can give us a call. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question, but just a comment on what you've just been talking about. Is the preparation for the X-ray the same as the preparation for a colon cancer test?
Oh, that's a great question. Right now, it is. They have actually looked at trying to do the virtual colonoscopy without doing a preparation, but the accuracy goes way down. They are trying to change the way the CT colography or virtual colonoscopy is being done to try to increase that accuracy, but that's still a work in progress, I believe.
Okay, so if the prep is the same, you might as well go for the gold standard.
Well, that's kind of the argument I think that most gastroenterologists would use. If we could change the preparation, make it more palatable, make it easier on patients, I think both sides would win on that one.
Okay, thank you for that answer. And my question is the esophagus part of the GI tract?
Yes.
And when you check the esophagus, you use a probe through the mouth, and how far down does the probe go?
On routine upper endoscopies, we go through to the first part of the small intestine. It's called the duodenum. And so that checks out the esophagus, the stomach, and the first to second portion of the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine.
Okay. And is there preparation for that?
Only that your stomach is empty. So that's an easier one.
Okay. So that means you have to fast for 12 to 14 hours?
Usually, yeah. It takes, on average, your stomach empties in about 4 to 8 hours. For aspiration risk purposes, we usually try to have people not have any solids for at least 2 to 12 hours prior to the procedure. So if we're doing procedures in the morning, I usually tell people nothing after midnight. If we're doing the procedures in the afternoon, we say clear liquids in the morning and then nothing after 8 or 9 o'clock because it empties fairly quickly.
Okay. Is that read quickly, or does it have to be sent out elsewhere? Do we have the capacity in this town in this community to read, or does it have to be sent out?
The upper endoscopy, you mean?
Right.
Yeah, that's much like the colonoscopy, that you have results right away. If you see ulcers, you can tell the patient right after the procedure, yeah, you have an ulcer or you have reflux issues. Biopsies are done routinely during upper endoscopies, just like with colonoscopies, and that takes about 48 hours to process, but that's all done locally.
Okay, and I had one more question about that. Are you sedated like with a colonoscopy?
Yes, the exact same sedation is usually used.
Okay, and how long does it take?
The upper endoscopy usually takes about 5 to 10 minutes to do. It's very quick.
And are you sedated?
Yes.
And how long does it take for the sedation to wear off?
Usually about 15 to 30 minutes. Most patients are monitored for a full hour after the last dose of sedation has been given.
Okay.
And most people are fine at that point, but we always recommend there's no driving or doing anything major that's going to involve judgment.
And you want somebody to drive the patient home?
Definitely, yes.
Okay. And who does the sedating? Is it an anesthesiologist or the people in the gastrointestinal lab?
It's usually the people in the gastrointestinal lab. So the nurse gives sedation and the supervision of the physician.
Okay. And I'm avoiding a particular kind of sedation. Are most doctors and nurses amenable to a sedation other than the one I'm avoiding?
It depends on what you're avoiding, I think. But we do have a lot of choices as to what we can use safely.
Okay, propofol is what I'm avoiding.
Yeah, and usually propofol is used in the operating room setting only. Mm-hmm. Not always. There are some GI labs that are being allowed to use that there. Routinely, either fentanyl or Demerol or morphine are used as the narcotic agents to sedate, and then Versed, which is like a short-acting Valium, mm-hmm. is used. So we don't usually use propofol in that setting.
Okay. Thank you so much for all this good information.
You're welcome.
Right. Well, thank you. Other people have questions on other digestive issues. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign. And you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Want to go back to we were talking about colonoscopy and talking about the prep that you have to go through. And at the risk of grossing folks out or making them think of something that's unpleasant, I mean, the fact of the matter is that what the preparation involves is you got to flush things out.
Right.
You don't
right.
want anything in there because you don't want anything obscuring your view. I mean,
exactly.
you want to be able to see the walls of the intestine, walls of the colon. So it has to be all clean, and that's
right.
that's the thing.
That's the goal.
And it's you know, kind of, it's a little unpleasant. At least you don't want to go too far away from home. when you're in fact, you don't want to go too far away from the bathroom is what you want. So, I mean, I guess, you know, given that that's what it is you have to accomplish, I guess when you say that the hope might be to do something that would make it a little, you know, less unpleasant, I'm not exactly sure how you could accomplish the goal of having the person be all cleaned out and make it, as, you know, any different than what it is.
Well, you know, there are different preps available, and we have made some progress in making it a little bit more pleasant. And obviously it's, at least so far, I'm on the opposite side of the prep, but my time will come, I hope. So I will be able to give you even better information probably after that. But the original preps were just enemas, which people were actually hospitalized, and they were given enemas, what they called to-and-fro enemas, large volume enemas, mm-hmm. To clean out as much as possible. We've obviously come a long way since then, and then we switched over to the oral laxatives. The original laxatives used were very large volume laxatives, such as Golightly or Colite, which are still around. They're safe laxatives, but it's almost a gallon of a fluid that you're trying to drink. And then, of course, you're on a clear liquid diet the day before. We've moved to smaller volume preps as much as possible, simply because it's so difficult to get that amount of volume in. People actually drop their core temperatures a little bit and start to get chills because they're drinking so much fluid. And if possible, it'd be nice to get a preparation that didn't have such a violent response, that was more of a gradual response. But that's very difficult to control and is very patient-dependent on how they respond to the laxatives. We have switched over to a Fleet's oral phosphosoda prep. That, unfortunately, was taken off the market by the company because there are some issues with phosphate and kidney dysfunction. So many people are now using what we know as the Miralax laxative that is available over the counter but in higher volume. I personally am also using magnesium citrate, which has been traditionally used for kidney patients. It's a safer prep. In combination with Dulcolex laxative tablets. I mean, there's all kinds of preps out there. There is still a phosphate-based pill prep if people are good at swallowing pills, because it involves about taking approximately 30 pills, which I would not do well with, but everybody's a little bit different on that. But that is phosphate-based, and so you do have to be careful if there's some potential kidney issues that cannot be used in patients with that.
Okay. Other callers, we have some. Let's go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Oh, good afternoon.
Yes.
I was just wondering, have you heard anything about drinking aloe vera juice for digestive health? And my second question would be, is there anything that one can drink or eat to keep the system in good shape? Thank you very much.
I've heard of the aloe vera juice, but I don't have much information on it. It's more of a holistic approach, and so I really can't even comment on it with much information. The only thing that that has been advertised to keep the polyp gods away, in essence, is a well-balanced diet, low fat, high fiber is what's usually recommended. You could argue that there are not fantastic studies out there to confirm that, and there was even, I almost hate to mention this, I guess on the air, there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that associated high fiber with an increased risk of colon polyps in one study, which was pretty much lambasted and decided, no, that's not accurate. It was an association that it happens from time to time in studies. So I think overall people are suggesting high-fiber diets, low-fat, less red meat. And a lot of that's based on actually looking at countries that have a very low colon cancer rate, such as Japan and Africa, where their fiber intake is much, much higher and their red meat intake is much, much lower. And their colon cancer rates are very, very low. There are some studies that have suggested that taking low doses of non-steroidal type medications on a fairly regular basis may decrease the polyp rate of growth. No one has actually recommended that, even higher risk groups, at least at the present time, because of other studies that have confounded those results. There have been studies that suggest taking low-dose aspirin every other day may be helpful in decreasing polyp rate of growth. And then calcium also seems to have some role in also decreasing risk of polyp growth or rate of growth. But those are kind of nebulous studies. There's a trend towards benefit, and they don't keep you from still having to do the screening.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you think about probiotics? Do they have some kind of general benefit?
I think probiotics have a role in digestive health. How much they actually are helpful as far as decreasing risk of colon cancer, I think, has not even been looked at very well. I don't think we have any studies to show that. I find that they are most helpful, and this is anecdotally, in patients that have irritable bowel syndrome or people that have had antibiotics that have been used for something else that can really throw off the GI tract. And I think they're very helpful in getting that back to a normal state. I wonder how much the yogurt itself is actually the healthy part of it as opposed to the probiotics, but I'm not sure I can comment more than that.
All right. To another caller, line two, Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have had a diagnosis of GERD and a prescription for omeprazole, and can't get a full day's worth of protection from omeprazole these days. Is there any hope?
There's always hope. some people do need to take the omeprazole twice daily to get the full 24-hour of coverage. They are supposed to last for about 24 hours, but certainly they will wear off, and everyone's different as how quickly they metabolize the medicines. Sometimes just the timing will make the difference in when you take the medicine. If you have mostly daytime issues, then taking the medicine before breakfast would be better. If you have more nighttime issues, taking it before supper. We do recommend that these medicines be taken before you eat because they're absorbed better. I always tell my patients they're absorbed better if you take them than if you don't take them. So if you forget, it's still fine to take after you eat, but the absorption is just not quite the same, so the efficacy is not quite the same. But certainly some patients do require twice-a-day dosing rather than just once a day.
There seems to be some contention about the potential side effects now of omeprazole. What's your view?
Well, which side effects are you concerned about?
It's been a while, and I don't really recall, but apparently some doctors are recommending against omeprazole.
Well, I know there have been concerns, and I'll review what I'm most familiar with, and I think has been out in the media as the most. There was a concern, actually originally when these medicines first came out, that they might increase the risk of a very rare type of stomach cancer called a gastrinoma. And I think that has been pretty much put to rest. Although I think the FDA the PDR actually still says you don't use this for more than 2 months at a time, but it's simply because it has not caught up with the literature. So that pretty much has been put to rest. This does not seem to increase the risk of stomach cancer unless you are a rat, which is what the studies were first based on, but it's not been shown in any other mammal.
I do recall that the side effect was that omeprazole might actually increase the production of stomach acid.
No, it does not do that, but it does increase the gastrin production, and gastrin causes stomach acid to be produced. So that was the concern originally about these tumors. There have been concerns about iron and calcium absorption because both of those ions are best absorbed if they're in an acidic state in an acid environment. However, the iron deficiencies have never developed in the situation that I think has been put to rest. Calcium absorption and increased risk of osteoporosis, I think, is still a question mark. Again, reflux disease is so common. The use of proton pump inhibitors like the omeprazole are so common, and osteoporosis is so common that it's very easy to make an association without proving a cause and effect issue. Now, what I always do is look at patients that have had stomach surgeries where acid production is totally gone. That's much more effective than any of these medicines can be. And those patients do not develop low calcium issues or calcium malabsorption issues. And to me, that makes the most sense to say, well, probably there's not a significant problem then from the omeprazole type medicines. If that's a concern, certainly taking a little bit of extra calcium a day wouldn't be a bad idea.
Is there any benefit to Pepcid AC type of medication?
If you're only having an occasional heartburn issue, then the Pepcid AC, Tagamet, Zantac, all these types of medicines are very beneficial because they work quickly within 30 minutes of taking the medicine, but they're not as strong. So if you have a very occasional heartburn just from abusing yourself for whatever reason, going out late to dinner or eating something very spicy or something that you know you just don't tolerate, then those medicines I think are very helpful. But they don't work as well if you have much more chronic reflux type problems. The downside then on the omeprazole is that it takes about 24 to 48 hours to get maximum effect, acid control effect from omeprazole type medicines. But then once you're on them for a while, they have much better sustainability of acid reduction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. There are a lot of people who take these medicines now, and they're available over the counter,
right?
The proton pump inhibitors. What do we know about how long you can take these? I mean, in terms of like how many years you can be taking these?
Well, there are a lot of patients that have taken them over a lifetime, and as has been the case in many situations, these medicines were released first in Europe before almost 5 to 10 years prior to them before they were released here or approved here for use. And so we have not only information from patients here, but also information from patients in Europe and studies from Europe where they were used even longer. There is a concern, and very rarely you will see something called tachyphylaxis where the medicine stops working as well because your body accommodates. It takes many years for that to happen if it ever happens. Mm-hmm. So I think we pretty much have put to rest that long-term use is safe for many years, for lifetime.
Okay. Other callers, and I think we'll next talk with someone in Monticello. Line number one. Hello.
Well, I just discovered that I'm taking that same, whatever it's called. I take Prilosec, and I take it every day. So I was just calling about that. But apparently that's what you were talking about. So
yeah, the omeprazole is the generic form of Prilosec.
Yeah. So I take it every day, and I have to take it all the time. And so I'm not going to worry about it then.
Good.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Very
Bye.
Good. Well, we'll go on to, I think, another champagne person here. Line two. Hello.
Yeah. What about the habit of simply brushing your teeth with baking soda after each meal and not having acid stomach?
Well, you know, baking soda will work. You can get acid suppression, or I should say,
reduction. It's a simple cross cut. Yeah.
Yeah. Just by making the secretions basic as opposed to acid. But in order to do that for long term, over a 24-hour period of time, which is what is necessary for significant reflux issues and for stomach ulcer healing, you'd have to use, you know, boxes of bicarb baking soda.
It isn't bad.
Pardon me? Yeah, it's not bad. And there's no downside on it. But if it's sodium-based, that can increase certainly blood pressure issues. But if it's a mild problem, you know, a lot of these old remedies, there's a reason that people took them. They worked.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and happy day.
All right. Thank you for the call. I have an email here from someone. This kind of goes back to the question that I asked about probiotics. So the person who's listening says that recently they tried the probiotics Acidophilus.
Yes.
And tried them according to the package directions for about 2 weeks. And then the person says, I found after about 2 weeks, my stomach felt very distended, as though my food wasn't digesting. In the mornings, I would wake up feeling that supper from the night before had not digested. So I stopped the probiotics, and after 2 or 3 days, I'm feeling better. Could I perhaps have introduced too much bacteria into my system? She says, by the way, she's 51 years old, and she is lactose intolerant and does indeed have irritable bowel syndrome. The kind that apparently that where a major symptom is constipation.
Well, it's hard to say. It could be variability of the irritable bowel syndrome. It could have been that some lactose was inadvertently introduced into the diet. The reason there's so much question with the probiotics is our upper GI tract and small intestines do not normally have bacteria there. It's not necessary in digestion. Occasionally, you will find some bacteria in the stomach that, again, that's a separate talk, I guess. But the small intestine is sterile. The stomach acidity breaks down bacteria. And so that's a fairly sterile environment as well. Now, the mouth is a different issue. But that's why the acid is there to a certain extent, is to keep things bacterial and infection-free. The colon is a very different issue. The colon has all kinds of bacteria, and that's healthy, and we need those bacteria there. So if you're taking probiotics by mouth, most of the bacteria will be broken down before they ever get to your colon, which is where it would do the most good. So there's always a question of, well, what are you really doing? So if you're introducing bacteria into an area that's usually sterile, bacteria break down sugars to produce gas and bloating, then, yeah, maybe you were getting some bacteria that hanging around were now causing the gas and the bloating. So that certainly theoretically would make sense. But there's so much variability there, it's hard to answer that concretely.
Okay. Well, hopefully that helps. We have someone to talk with in Sycamore, up in the northern part of the state. Line 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping your guest can discuss rectal fissures, what they're... why they don't heal on their own, and what the treatment is.
Well, this is a vexing problem and very, very painful and uncomfortable for many patients. Rectal fissures are, and I can speak to a certain extent certainly on them, rectal fissures are a crack in the skin in the anal canal that is much like a chapped lip. It will, every time someone has a bowel movement, the skin spreads apart, and then that will crack open or pop open again. So much like a chapped lip, if you smile and it actually pops the skin, every time you smile, it keeps doing that. And since we are having bowel movements every day, that becomes a difficult time. You can keep from smiling, but I don't think you can do much about the bowel movements, and you don't want to, I suppose. But it's very uncomfortable. It actually can cause a spasming of the internal anal sphincter muscle below, which can cause a terrible pain, a searing type of pain. And so you really try to get those healed as best you can. So first off, what I usually tell people is treat your butt the same way you treat your lips. You don't get a bunch of soap up there. You don't dry that skin out. You must be very gentle to it. So again, the same things that work well on your lips, which are the soluble lotions, A&D ointment, for example, is very, very good for your bottom. If you think about babies with that are constantly changing diapers, the A&D ointment is great. The aloe wipes, non-alcohol-based diaper wipes are great because it gently cleanses the area without drying the skin out. Sometimes antibiotic therapy will help if these fissures are not healing. Certainly making the bowel movements as soft as possible without causing diarrhea will cause less tension on the skin to decrease the risk of them popping open again. Sometimes, however, you just cannot get them healed. And in that case, surgery is necessary to actually cut the fissure area out. And they usually will lance that internal anal sphincter muscle at the same time to keep it from spasming again. We do have two anal sphincters, so that's usually well tolerated.
Okay, very interesting. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign and is with us here to talk about digestive system issues. And if you got a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I have another email here from someone who says, have doctors found any way to break the connection between stress and stomach upset? And he goes on to say, if stress can't be avoided, what's the best way to keep its gastrointestinal effects down to a minimum?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I would be even more famous than I infamous than I am now.
You'd get your Nobel Prize there.
That's right. Stress does a lot of things. It increases gastric acid secretion. It affects the motility of the entire GI tract. And we think part of that may be secondary to adrenaline actually being released when you're stressed. And that can actually increase motility. Some people get diarrhea when they're really stressed. And there's actual neurologic and receptor reasons for that happening. We can explain why that's happening. But controlling it is a different issue. The neuroreceptors in the GI tract are as complex as the neuroreceptors in our brain. There are so many hormones and neuroendocrine chemicals that are affected by stress that then affect our GI tract that many of them have not even been described. If you can affect the stress, whether it be chemically or if you can control it yourself, then that's what you aim to do. There are some medicines that can block some of the stress-induced changes, the movement variabilities. Those are things like dicyclamine or Bentyl, hyoscyamine or Levsun, Donatol. These are all medicines that are often used that can block that response to a certain extent. We've used them with some success. We know that fiber supplements help normalize GI tract movement, and that can sometimes decrease the response of your GI tract to the stress that you're having and make a less potent response. And then there's a big I don't know, because some people don't always respond to those. Second-line therapies often involve psychiatric medications, which also have an effect on the GI tract, but also do something centrally in the brain to decrease that response as well. So when people are put on things like buspirinone or Elavil or amitriptyline, these are antidepressant, anti-anxiolytic type medicines. But we're not putting people on them because we think they're crazy. We're doing it because there's actually a response that we're trying to block and lessen the GI tract's response to what's going on with stressors.
Mm. So obviously, though, you're talking about some very powerful medications, so I guess that's not something you'd want to do lightly.
Right. We usually go through the first-line medicines that kind of block that response that you can take as needed. We start with those first. Those are medicines that have been around forever. Before we go to the second step, which is these psychiatric medicines.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk with somebody in Champaign County. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Very pertinent. I wanted to ask about colonoscopy. I gather that's something that you're able to ask a question about.
Sure.
And it's got to do with the frequency. I'm approaching 60, and I have a family history. My mother survived type 2 colon cancer, and my brother has polyps frequently. And I thought I was on a 4-year cycle. I just and I just had a visit to the doctor, and he said, no, it's 5 years. But I'm sure I remember that he suggested that with that kind of family history. Maybe I should be 4 months older or something. After 60, it's 4 years if you have a family history or something. But, you know, I don't really relish the idea of having one, but I just, you know, I know that from talking to other people who've had colon cancers that you don't necessarily have any symptoms. So if I'm in a higher risk category, shouldn't the frequency be more often? And I'm smelling the HMO, and I'm wondering whether you would confirm that. It's actually a colleague of yours, so.
Okay. Usually, and this is what the American Gastroenterological Association and the cancer societies have recommended in low-risk groups, which are no family histories and no there's sort of other variables that can be thrown in there. But low-risk patients at age 45 to 50, you should have your first colonoscopy, and then if there are no polyps found, every 10 years thereafter. If polyps are found that are precancerous type, depending on the number and the size, we usually go to every 3 to 5 years, and also depends on was your prep good the first time. I mean, I will sometimes do a colonoscopy and by the book, you would say, okay, your next colonoscopy should be in 5 years, but the preparation wasn't quite so good. So I will say, well, let's do this again in 3 years because I'm not sure I saw things as well as I would have liked. So there is some operator variability there. Routinely, in your family history situation, if your brother was in his 60s or younger when he had the polyps and your mother was also in her 60s when she had the colon cancer, and I guess by definition, since two people in your family were affected, your risk is slightly higher. But as long as you don't have polyps, every 5 years is what's recommended.
Well, I had the benign polyps. Okay. On one of the two that I've had so far. So.
Right. So the rule of thumb there is if you had less than 3 benign precancerous type polyps and they were all less than 1 centimeter in size.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I know. Then 5 years would be fine. So I think I'm agreeing with your physician's recommendation.
I see. Depending whether that's those things apply, like you said, if I had 4. And one, or maybe if one of them was larger than that or something.
Then when we would have said 3 years would have been the recommendation for that situation.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. Well, the cancers that we're talking about, are they, how quickly do they grow? Are they rather fast or rather slow?
Usually fairly slow in most situations. There are some, again, atypical situations that are usually a genetic issue that they'll grow faster and not necessarily go through that polyp phase. Uh-huh. Or a flat polyp phase where you just can't even see anything. You can't screen normally. But most of the time, on average, they will say it takes anywhere from 6 to 12 years for a polyp to grow and become a cancer.
So that's why if you have someone who does not have a family history, that you can say, and if you do a colonoscopy and you don't find anything, that's why to that person, then you're going to say, okay, we'll see you in 10 years.
Right, right. All right.
What's your thought about flexible sigmoid as an option?
I think when I first started in these interviews that sigmoidoscopies were still being recommended as a possible screening exam. But I think that has really changed at this point. You could still argue that they're an okay way of screening as long as you're very diligent with follow-up and do them fairly frequently. Mm-hmm. But as far as a screening exam, it's pretty much gone by the wayside because studies are showing that we're finding more and more polyps on the right side of the colon where the sigmoidoscopy cannot reach. Whereas before, it was studies had shown that there were more left-sided polyps, and that's why it was an okay screening tool. But more and more, we're seeing more things on the right side without anything on the left side. And so as a screening tool, it's probably not the best.
Hmm. Okay. Well, other questions are welcome, and we're down to having maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist from Christie Clinic in Champaign. You have digestive system questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We did talk a little bit about gastric reflux, which apparently we're seeing more and more, and certainly there are medications now for this, a lot of medications that are fairly heavily being marketed. So it's a problem people are certainly aware of. There seems to be an awful lot of it around. Why do you think that there's a good reason for it? Why is it that so many people seem to be complaining about frequent heartburn?
Well, I'm not sure if it's media related because we're talking about it so much more that everyone says, "Oh yeah, I have that," or if it is an increasing issue. It probably is an increasing issue to a certain extent. We're a very fast paced society. Everything has to be done now, 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 now. It's type A society, I think. A lot of caffeine intake. Caffeine does increase potential for reflux issues. And also, unfortunately, our obesity issues are going up and up. And that also increases potential for reflux because the pressure on the sphincter muscle in the lower esophagus is being overcome by the weight pressures. Yeah. So all of that plays in.
So when it, so one of the first things, when you have somebody who has that as a complaint, and if they are heavier over their healthy weight, that's one of the first things that you're going to tell them. Well, it'd be a good idea for you to, for probably for a number of reasons, to lose some weight.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, and in addition to that, you would tell them to watch their caffeine intake, probably also watch your alcohol intake. Are there, I think for some people, particular foods seem to be problematic, and for other people, not.
Exactly.
Is there anything general that you can say about just watching what you eat?
Well, there are different issues that you certainly can watch. The caffeine intake, and it's not just coffee. It can be tea. It can be sodas. There's some sodas, and certainly they're very high in caffeine that are being made to give you the energy. But what caffeine does is relax the lower esophageal sphincter muscle, and it certainly increases the potential for reflux. So when someone comes in and says, "I drink a pot to two pots of coffee a day," that's a problem, okay? But and I have heartburn. So that would be the number one thing to work on. Mm-hmm. I do have patients that come in like that, or I drink 10 Mountain Dews a day. That's an issue, and that's certainly contributing to the problem. Yeah. There are also other foods that can actually relax that sphincter muscle, and those do include tomatoes and mint. So this is tomato season. If you don't have reflux before and you're eating lots of tomatoes right now, that may be part of the issue, or anything that's tomato-based, certainly. And very strong mints can also do that. It just has a relaxant effect. Now, I've had some patients that have come in and told me they have reflux, but that a mint helps. And that makes me wonder if maybe it's not so much reflux as more of a movement type thing, and the relaxation of the muscles helps their symptoms. So,
well, it does. I certainly have noticed, you know, if you go down to the health food store and you look at herbal tea and you look at all the things that are said to be soothing, it seems like they almost all have mint in them.
Right, right. Yeah, mint has a very, very soothing, relaxing effect on the GI tract. So that's great if you've got an overactive system. For example, the stress-induced stomach upset may actually respond to mint if it's not an acid-based issue. Whereas if it's an acid-based issue, the mint-based products may actually increase the reflux and the symptoms.
Okay.
So
we have two people here. We'll try to get them both. First in line, McLean County. Line one, hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a couple questions, but I'll try to make them very fast. One of them is, the important one is, if someone's sphincter of OD has had a sphincterotomy, how does that affect in terms of food going through the duodenum, whether it's going to back into the bile duct or other potential problems in that area?
Well, that's an interesting question. My training actually dealt a lot with sphincter of OD dysfunction, and so we had a lot of patients that had the sphincter cut. And this is the opening where the bile duct enters into the duodenum, into the small intestine, to let bile flow in. Sometimes that can be scarred, or it will spasm and cause pain, and cutting that is actually the treatment of choice. We have found that when you do that, of course, it does open up the bile duct to air from the GI tract and sometimes even bacteria. If this is done at a very young age, it may predispose to stone formation in the bile duct later in life, 50s, 60s, 70s, etc. So if possible, we try not to cut that sphincter muscle. If you have stones, however, and you're young, there's not a whole lot of choice but to open that up to pull those stones out. Later in life, it's less of an issue. So it's just going to have less time of exposure to the air and bacteria, and so there's less of an issue if you're in your 50s and 60s, if you do cut that muscle, having any side effects. Now, it does, however, instead of controlling how quickly bile will go from the bile duct into the intestine, will cause sometimes a rush of bile, and bile is irritating to the small intestine. So much like when people sometimes have diarrhea issues after their gallbladder is taken out because of the rush of bile being secreted into the intestine, some people have the same issue after the sphincter of Oddi has been cut.
Does the food ever back up? You said air and...
Usually, because this cut is fairly small, there's not a problem with food backing up. Because it's about a... We always say we probably cut about a centimeter up, but the bile duct is not that big that it could even accommodate that. So it's usually just air. Now, there are surgeries that really open up the bile duct to the intestine, and that can be a problem with food in that case. But they have changed the type of surgeries that are being done, so that's less of an issue.
Because I had that done and actually solved one problem and created another.
Yeah.
I cannot handle any pressure. I can't squat with my knees to my chest. I cannot have any pressure. And I have many more problems with gas and trigger pains. And I was even afraid that maybe it was food backing up or something. But so you're saying basically gas. Is there anything you can do to keep from having these problems? I mean, I take Levsin or Bentol if it gets bad, I'll take it. But I hate taking it because then I have to be careful what I do, you know.
Right. And it's difficult. The Levsin, the Bentol is probably the best, and it's really more of a symptomatic control of the symptoms. How much symptoms are actually caused by air going up there, I think can be argued somewhat, but that's very difficult to say.
Nope, but just in general, the pain caused by, maybe a spasm is causing the pain. Is there anything else? I mean, just general question, is there anything you can do or not?
Well, sometimes there are patients with sphincter of Oddi issues because of potential for bile crystals are put on medicines like Ursodiol or Actigal, which help keep the bile soluble and less crystalline, mm-hmm. and that sometimes will help symptomatically.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm going to hang up so the next person can
okay.
talk with you, too. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We'll try to get real quick here to Bloomington. Line 4, go ahead.
Yeah, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends a colonoscopy not be performed after age 75, saying that it's not worth the risk. What is your opinion of that?
Yeah, the entire recommendation actually says I would agree with that recommendation to a certain extent. It depends a bit on the health of the patient. And as we are becoming an older and older society, and since it takes about 6 to 12 years for colon cancers to form, polyps to form and then become cancers, we're going to have more and more patients at the age of 90 presenting with colon cancers if they quit having their colonoscopies at age 75. So it is a bit patient dependent on when that should be stopped. Usually between 75 and 80, I personally would agree. But again, I've done colonoscopies up into 85 years of age. But it depends on the situation as well.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. My apologies. We have one more person we can't take, but we just simply don't have the time. And maybe another day, a few months down the road, Dr. Nugent will come back. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Dr. Claudia Nugent, she is a gastroenterologist, and she works at Christie Clinic in Champaign.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at subaruofchampaign.com or 352-4700.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
And that's it for us on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
And you are tuned to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and FM HD3 Urbana. In Kansas City, September wheat is trading at $7.75. That is down 16¼. December, $7.15¼, down 16¼. In Chicago, September wheat, $6.73, down 19¼. December, $7.06, down 19½. September corn, $4.02¼, down 15. December, $4.17½, down 15¼. March, $4.31¼, down 15. May, $4.38½, down 14½. September beans, $10.05. That is down 6.5. November, $9.98 and a quarter, down 7.25. January, $10.05 and a quarter, down 7.5. March, $10.09, down 8.5. September meal, $296.80, down $4.60. September oil, $39.37, up 12. August live cattle, $99.10, down 62.5. October, $99.20, down 55. August feeder cattle, $114.60, down 15. September, $116.17.5, down 72.5. October lean hog, $76.87.5. That is off 135. October crude, 7.